Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's pledge in Poland to bolster NATO with a $1 billion boost to military deployments in Europe. A leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia, Daniel Treisman, who is just back from Russia, joins us to discuss Russia's threat to pull out of the 1997 NATO-Russia Founding Act if there are major NATO deployments in Eastern and Central Europe, and whether or not there is an appetite on both sides for an increase in defense spending or a new arms race in Europe as former Warsaw Pact countries grow increasingly nervous of Russia following its invasion of Ukraine. Then we'll look into how Republican operatives have organized soldiers from Sergeant Bergdahl's former unit and offered them up to the press to criticize the American POW who was swapped by the Obama administration for Taliban prisoners. Robert Creamer, a longtime political organizer and strategist and author of Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, The Despicable Republican Attack on an American Prisoner of War, and why the mainstream media have enabled the attacks on Bergdahl, who, if he is, as it appears, a deserter, will be judged by the military. But in the meantime, the POW is being smeared in the right-wing press as a way to attack Obama. Then finally, we will speak with Scott Savitt, a former Beijing-based foreign correspondent who covered the Tiananmen Square massacre 25 years ago for the Los Angeles Times and United Press International. He joins us to discuss the media blackout in China on this June 4th anniversary and whether the Communist Party leaders have erased the pro-democracy movement entirely by encouraging nationalism and generating an economic growth, improving the standard of living to the point where the average Chinese citizen today has 20 times the income they had 25 years ago. And joining us now is Daniel Treisman, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He's a recipient of the fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and is the author of two previous books on Russia, the latest of which is Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Treisman.
Hi, happy to be here.
And Daniel, you were just back from Russia, and I'm trying to get a sense here of whether there's any kind of buyer's remorse in Russia following the outpouring of nationalism and fervor during the annexation of Crimea and into this whole confrontation with Ukraine, where of course Putin has shot right up in the polls. But it appears lately, in fact, today in Poland, President Obama went out of his way to say that he wants good relations with Russia and understands their concerns about their borders and their neighbors. And my understanding is that actually Putin and Obama have a pretty good relationship and talk often on the phone. So is this thing starting to wind down a bit?
Well, it definitely felt to me in Russia that there was a desire on the part of many people, but including Putin himself, to at least stabilize things and maybe get back to slightly more normal relations. I heard Putin talk at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum about 10 days ago. He gave a big speech in which he seemed comfortable, relaxed, somewhat combative. He made his usual jokes. And he gave the usual narrative about how badly he's been treated, how disrespectfully he's been treated by the U.S., Europe, and the Ukrainians now. But his tone was one of, I'm magnanimous. I will deal with this in a civilized way, and I hope that we can get back to normal. So I think he would like things to calm down, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to give up on anything, or he's made his point that he can destabilize Eastern Ukraine whenever he wants to, and he'll still have that capacity even if things do return to a somewhat more normal basis.
But Russia have said that they will pull out of the 1997 NATO-Russia Founding Act should there be major NATO deployments in Eastern and Central Europe. And the president announced in Poland on Tuesday that the U.S. is boosting deployments with a $1 billion fund, which doesn't, in the real world, doesn't amount to an awful lot. So what's your sense of whether or not this thing is going to start, there's going to be a action-reaction, not obviously an arms race like the Cold War, but if the former Warsaw Pact countries are nervous about this newly assertive Russia, will they spend more, and will, therefore, Russia spend more?
Well, it's been pointed out in the last few months that the NATO members other than the U.S. have mostly been spending less than they're supposed to under the agreement. So they, especially during the global financial crisis, Europe has been really trying to cut back on military spending. At the same time, the East European countries closest to Russia, in particular the Baltic states and Poland, are understandably very nervous about the precedent that Crimea sets. And I think everybody recognizes that we live in a new, much more uncertain world where you simply can't assume that Putin won't do something that has very large potential costs because he's already done that. So I think there's a great desire by all the many of the East European countries, not all, some of them are actually quite supportive of Russia, but many of them to have the U.S. spend more and deploy more military in their countries to provide a visible commitment. But I don't know if we're going to see very big increases in military spending in those countries. And to be honest, you know, even a 5% increase in military spending or even a 20% increase in military spending in Lithuania or Estonia isn't going to make a huge difference. As it is, though, I should say, NATO has an overwhelming superiority compared to Russia across the board. Russia clearly has a superiority on the ground in specific places when NATO isn't mobilized. But NATO spends in total about $1 trillion a year. Russia spends less than $100 billion on the military. So it's 10 to 1.
So, again, I'm speaking with Daniel Treisman, who has been a long-time specialist on politics and economics in post-communist Russia. He's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a recipient of of a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States. And he's the author of two previous books on Russia, the latest of which is Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. So, in your meetings in Moscow and St. Petersburg with Russian officials, did you get the feeling that anybody has quite figured out what happened here? Was this an impetuous act on Putin's part, seizing Crimea? Had he invested too much in Yanukovych? Was he caught by surprise when the people rose up and kicked Yanukovych out? I'm just not sure of what happened here, whether, because much has been made about it, and everybody's now talking about Putin being a 19th century Russian imperialist, but it may be there's some simpler explanation. He just got freaked out.
Well, yeah, I can't pretend that I have sources very close to Putin, but the general impression that one gets from looking very closely at what happened and talking to some people in Moscow close to what's going on, the sense one gets is that it really wasn't a planned action. Obviously, they had contingency plans for various possibilities, but everything suggests that Putin made this decision quite suddenly, without broad consultation with people in his government or other advisors, that it happened right after the deal that had been negotiated between Yanukovych, the Ukrainian president at that time, and the opposition leaders, when that deal fell apart. And Putin had apparently persuaded Yanukovych to accept that deal, which would have eased the way to Yanukovych leaving power as the new elections approached, or in the interim would have meant a deal for cooperation, a coalition government, and so on. That deal fell apart. Putin felt betrayed, from what we understand, by the West for not pressuring the opposition to stick to that deal. And he felt a very strong action was necessary, and he chose the option of Crimea, as we saw. But even then, various indications suggest that they hadn't decided to actually annex Crimea. The initial plan was for Crimea simply to become a sort of independent state, or to declare independence and have this unclear international status. And then, improvising along the way, they came to a point where they decided that they would actually accept Crimea as part of Russia. But so it seems to have developed through a sort of complicated contingent set of events, and it really doesn't look like the unfolding of some master plan for expansion that Putin has been secretly developing for the last 14 years in power.
So what's the sense, though, in Russia? Obviously, there are sort of two Russias, the one that looks inward and the one that looks outward to the West. And at this point, we're told that the more nationalistic majority has the upper hand, and that the pro-Western liberals are all kind of, they've been totally marginalized by Putin. He's taken away, taken control of the press. Now he's taking over the internet. There's pretty much nowhere for them to go. But are Russians concerned about the negative views that the rest of the world has? The BBC just did a poll from their World Service saying that negative views of Russia now average 45% across most of the countries in the world that they've polled, with the exception of China.
Right. I think, and I can only judge from what I saw in St. Petersburg and Moscow on this last trip. I don't know if people are, it varies. Among people in academic circles, the intelligentsia in Moscow, the circles where I have most friends, a lot of people are very unhappy. They're disgusted, ashamed at this latest move in Crimea. More people are talking about leaving, who actually have plans to leave, or at least buy an apartment somewhere else to have a place abroad, than ever in my time of going to Russia. So there's a sense of uncertainty, really disagreement with the foreign policy. At the same time, overall, you feel a great desire for normality. And you might get a sense from the West that people are all huddling around their TVs in Moscow or waiting for the latest bulletin and so on, but not at all. Life continues very, very normally in the streets. There isn't this sense of any aggression towards the U.S. or the West. Moscow's full of American tourists. Everybody seems delighted to have them there. It's just a much more casual atmosphere than I had expected going over there. And I think that's based in part on just a desire to get over this and to get back to normal life. But the economy is going to get worse. It was getting worse before the latest events in Crimea. And although the sanctions themselves haven't had a huge impact, the additional uncertainty they've created for investors, I think, will continue to mean capital outflows, poor growth performance, and that's I think what people are most afraid of.
So back to the president's meeting in Poland, where he had dinner with the Ukrainian president-elect Petro Poroshenko, and also the Hungarian president and the Belgian foreign minister, along with the Polish president, who was hosting the dinner. And on Thursday, of course, the president will be in Brussels for the NATO meeting. And then there'll also be the meeting in France for the commemoration of D-Day, at which it's expected the president will spend some time with Putin. He also mentioned in his press conference in Poland that François Hollande and the British Prime Minister would hopefully also talk to Putin about trying to, get past this crisis and mend fences. The real basket case in this is Ukraine, isn't it?
Ukraine is in trouble, and the West has made promises to provide economic aid. It needs serious economic aid. We didn't realize until we saw all of this unfold just in what desperately unstable state the state was. Just the failure of the Ukrainian army really to, until now, fight with any success against what were mostly just local volunteer troops really says a lot. And the ineffectiveness of the state, where these local oligarchs are really the only source of power at the moment that seems to be functioning, has really come as quite a shock. So there's a huge job rebuilding the economy of Ukraine and creating an effective democratic state there, and we don't know if that's going to happen or not. Poroshenko obviously wants to try and make a success of it. He's going to have to negotiate with the Russians. I think the Russians will negotiate with him. Putin in St. Petersburg said quite clearly that Russia would respect the outcome of the election, that they would deal with the new authorities, even if they didn't think that Yanukovych was removed in a constitutional way. Nevertheless, they would move on. There's a lot to be done, and we'll see how it goes. It'll depend on a lot of Western financial support, but at the same time, Putin probably doesn't want it to be seen to be a success. So it's a very delicate, difficult task.
Well, already, though, Russia's giving Ukraine more time to pay for the outstanding gas bill, which is something around $3 billion or something?
It keeps changing.
Yeah, it keeps changing, yeah.
They've reduced a bit of it. They also reduced the price back to, I think, $385 or something around that, $385 a 1,000 cubic meters. A lot of the bill depends on all sorts of assumptions that they choose to make or not to make about the past contract. So it's hard to keep track of the exact amount. But it does suggest, as you indicate, that there is a desire at this point, and it may be just while these meetings in Europe are taking place, to avoid a real showdown over the gas.
Or it seems like everybody's sort of backpedaling too. I mean, I don't know that this deployment of the extra $1 billion that Obama has announced is going to meet the threshold that the Russians are warning about pulling out of NATO on. It sounds like $1 billion is not going to. And frankly, I'm not even sure why. You know, NATO may be outspending Russia 10-1, but it doesn't seem to be much of a military threat. I'm trying to navigate here between Russian propaganda and the reality, you know.
Yeah, I don't think realistically it's a military threat to Russia, although when you do have that big imbalance and you have a military alliance moving closer and closer to your borders, it's clear why people would feel uncertain and uncomfortable. Nevertheless, I don't think it's a serious military threat. At the same time, Russia has a obvious local advantage in that it can move its troops in fast across the border, and it has proved to be really effective in this kind of new warfare where you send in unmarked troops very quickly, quietly. You use massive propaganda at the same time, and you change the facts on the ground without actually having to invade with tanks and so on.
But, right. You use the GRU the KGB or the FSB. Right. Not surprising that a former KGB officer is in charge. I mean, everybody's pretty much thinks that Putin pulled off an extraordinary operation, particularly in Crimea, but it feels a bit like it's all backfiring a little on him now.
Well, it's also the case, it seems pretty clear, that a lot of what's going on in the eastern Ukraine is not under complete control of the Russian authorities. There's volunteers there, these diehard nationalists who've been volunteering in all the failed state conflicts like Transnistria and Moldova, Chechnya and so on, who just turn up where there's fighting going on. So there's that, and there's also now this so-called Vostok battalion, which is made up of some Chechens and various other volunteers, apparently sent by Kadyrov, president of Chechnya, to go and help out and make trouble in eastern Ukraine. And it's not clear that all of that, in fact, it's very unlikely, I think, that all of that is really under the control of the Russian forces. It was much, much more unified, coherent operation in Crimea.
Well, Daniel Treisman, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Treisman, who's a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia. He's a recipient of a fellowship from the John Simon Guggenheim Foundation and the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and is the author of two previous books on Russia, the latest of which is Return, Russia's Journey from Gorbachev to Medvedev. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into how Republican operatives organized soldiers from Sergeant Bergdahl's former unit to smear him.